From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Several southern and midwestern states have enacted bans or significant limits on abortion. Legislators are hoping to get the Supreme Court to reverse Roe v. Wade. But what will the effects of those bills be on presidential voters? We'll examine that issue as well as many other in politics right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you had a great weekend. So good to have you starting the work week together. We do it with politics. Monday's first hour, no different today. We have a lot to get to. But later in the program, we open up our lines to hear from you. Your favorite series finale episode of all time. We're going to hear what you think is the very best. This in light of Game of Thrones coming to its end last night. And of course, we had the Big Bang Theory last week with its final episode as well. What's your favorite? We'll take your calls coming up in the second hour. But first, we're joined, as we are so many Mondays, by Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, former senior Obama advisor in 2008, and Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst who was an advisor to California Governors Wilson and Schwarzenegger and former White House staffer for President Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Gentlemen, good to have you with us. Sean, I just wanted to ask you about your former boss, Governor Schwarzenegger, getting hit from behind by a flying kick at an event in South Africa. Seemed like he barely knew he got hit.
Well, there's a reason they call him the Austrian oak. I mean, yeah. Not only are his biceps bulging, but his legs are literally like oak trees. And so it takes a lot to knock him over.
Yeah, I mean, just from my couple of times standing next to him, it's like good luck trying to knock him down. But a rather shocking thing nonetheless for him to be physically attacked like that. Let's start with the anti-abortion bills in many of the southern and midwestern states. And we know, of course, what the legislatures are doing there is trying to set up the test case that goes to the Supreme Court so that they could potentially, if not overturn Roe v. Wade, carve out additional latitude for states to restrict abortion. Matt, your thoughts on the political dynamics of this? Does it have any effect on the primary races at all?
Well, I think it will have some. It gives some fodder to Democrats who are running to sort of just one of them will, you know, try to make as much hay out of this as possible. The challenge with it is they're all essentially in the same position. So what do you do that's, you know, what do you say? You try to be as histrionic as possible, but essentially all the candidates in the Democratic primary are obviously going to be against this. I think this has been kind of interesting. You've seen a couple of Democratic states started a little bit of moving a little further left on abortion and sort of opening up sort of more options for abortion. Now you're seeing the southern states whack hard, very hard back, obviously looking to go to the Supreme Court. These are obviously very red states, so I don't know if there'll be a big political price to pay in the state. But if you look at abortion over the last 40, 45 years since Roe, polling's been oddly pretty stable. There's actually a fair amount of women who are against abortion.
Yeah, there's not a big gender difference, which surprises people.
No, and so you like the Democrats spend a lot of time saying this is all about a war on women. But if you look at the gap, it's actually not that big a gender gap. And the numbers have stayed fairly stable. People are still who are for it are for it. People who are against it are against it. It has not been a big change. It'll be curious because this is obviously the most extreme example. And this is essentially in Alabama, essentially banning it for all intents and purposes. And so we're going to have to see if that plays any differently. Most Americans have sort of learned to live with this to say, I personally don't like it, but I want it to be legal, or I'm against it. But generally, it's sort of stayed in a fairly stable place. For some reason, in the last 5 to 10 years, this is starting to pop up as states are getting much more aggressive on the left and the right, most notably the right. But we're going to have to see if that changes the politics at all. They have not really changed that much over the last 40 years.
But, of course, with Kavanaugh, adding to the conservative bloc of the court,
yes,
that's what anti-abortion activists are hopeful.
Exactly. And I think that's what the big issue is. Typically, I think Republicans have been much better and much more aggressive, as well as their voters much more responsive to saying, We want certain types of elected officials. We're going to support these types of judges. Democrats say it, but has not been an animating feature of their voting habits. Certainly, it helped Trump a great deal in 2016, as he was very aggressive, saying these are the types of judges I'm going to put out there. I think that mattered in terms of voters. It has not mattered, I think, as much to Democrats. We're going to have to see if that changes now that the court seems poised to potentially move even further right.
Yeah, I wonder with the stakes what they are, if that does shift things. Sean, your thoughts about the political dimension of the abortion restrictions?
Well, I agree with Matt with regards to the overall sentiment in the public. You know, the Democrats have argued historically their kind of mantra is safe, legal, and rare. And though, you know, that's kind of evolved a little bit, I think, with some of, and Matt alluded to it, there were some bills put forward in New York, and I believe it was Connecticut.
Virginia.
To try and
expand
abortion rights in those states. Rights, I guess, is a relative term, but expand the time when abortion's allowable. So so I think that the scene is set to try and call for a fight on these particular issues. I think Democrats think this is a winning issue for them. I think they believe they can motivate women who came out and knocked off a lot of Republicans in Congress in the last election cycle. And again, you don't need a lot to make a major impact in the country. That said, too, though, on some Republican sides or on the conservative side, abortion is a motivating issue. And so that may motivate more people to come out on the Republican side. So I'm not sure on the politics side what that means from electoral cycle. But if I had to venture a guess, and as a Republican and a moderate, troubled pro-choice Republican, it's not a fight I'd actually like to see right now in a political dynamic coming up in the next election cycle when you have 25 Republican United States senators that are up on the ballot.
Well, it's interesting. President Trump tweeted out his specific position on abortion, that he favored exceptions for cases of rape and incest. So essentially he's saying he disagreed with the Alabama law that's the thoroughgoing ban.
Yeah, this is a setup, honestly, to challenge. There's a lot of folks who are really fundamentally and morally believe that abortion is wrong. And, you know, they're not evil people if they're pro-life. I mean, a lot of people hold a lot of convictions, and people that are pro-choice are not evil people as well. They just hold fundamentally different views. And so there are another group of folks that believe that Roe v. Wade should be a quote-unquote states' rights issue. States should have the ability to set those types of laws themselves, and other people think this is a fundamental right and the federal government should set it up. So I think right now you've got a whole confluence of folks that are both states' rights folks as well as just fundamental advocates. And one last thing, Larry, I'm sorry for taking too much time.
That's
here.
Right.
I do think that we should look at Chief Justice Roberts. He's shown an indication that he wants to have the courts branded in his name. And I really wonder whether in Roberts' heart of hearts, whether he wants to let this thing go down. So I bet he would be a vote that probably would sustain.
I was going to say something similar, which is, and I'm no lawyer, Sean can obviously run circles around me on that, but I do wonder if a lot of the lower courts strike this down, which is clearly in contravention of Roe v. Wade. I mean, it seems obvious. And so I think the question is there a way to get this to the Supreme Court, or does he really, you know, does Roberts want? I think there's concern enough that the court is already being politicized. It's clearly been over the last 10, 20 years, certainly since Bush v. Gore. But this, you can argue this goes all the way back to Bork in the 1980s. There's been a continual politicization of the court. I wonder if Roberts will try to find a way not to necessarily grant this. There's other abortion cases moving. I wonder if he's not going to want to grant this cert over the long run. And some of that will depend on what happens in the lower courts. But
well,
it's
a concern.
Well, I think
that's the thinking behind the ones that are somewhat more limited in the restrictions.
Correct.
As opposed to the Alabama one, which I think is the court probably doesn't want to go full on with that one. But I think the presumption is, too, that you're not going to see these restrictions go into effect before the Supreme Court has a chance to weigh in on
it. And the legislators knew that. Alabama knew it going in. This is not a stunt. I mean, it is kind of a stunt, but it was geared towards one outcome and one outcome only. And that's going to take potentially years to play out.
Let's turn our attention to a Republican member of Congress from Michigan, Justin Amash. the first Republican who says that what the Mueller report details are impeachable offenses. Now, Amash, of course, is a small L libertarian Republican, as Joaquin in South L.A. posts on the page. He's always been an outliner, a rhino or Republican in name only, and not saying that as a pejorative, Joaquin says. He reached an independent conclusion and articulated it to the public. Sean, your thoughts about Amash? He's gotten a lot of attention for this. Does it mean anything?
Well, I think he's probably got outsized attention. It's man bites dog a little bit. And I will say, I do think the media tends to really take Trump to task on anything. And if they find one little thing they can bash him on, they do it. So this is really not much. And, you know, we've got the senator from Kentucky who is a libertarian himself and occasionally goes out on these off tangents and is on the other side of President Trump as well. So this is like a nothing burger, but, you know, it gets a little bit of attention because it's the first Republican stepping out.
Well, and it enables Amash to sort of further identify himself, as Rand Paul has done, as a libertarian-minded Republican. Quick thought on this, Matt.
I think it's probably a couple of days story. It's interesting because if you think about it, in a lot of ways, because of Trump's stonewalling or in some ways, the Mueller report and impeachment are kind of moving in a different direction, right? I think it's really hard for Democrats to really get their hands around. I think there's been some frustration with at least House Democrats. But I feel like the public is kind of moving on. And so and this guy sort of jumps right into it. It's sort of a strange timing. I don't know if he has his own political reasoning or if he just likes being iconoclastic, but not clear what he's trying to achieve here. But my guess is by Wednesday, we won't even remember this guy's name again.
Speaking of the Mueller report, it has fallen off the daily news cycle now as apparently the negotiations continue for Robert Mueller's appearance before congressional committees. Matt, where do you see Democrats going with this next?
Well, they've kind of painted themselves to some degree into a corner, which is they've now basically said the only person who can clear any of this up is Mueller. Now, the question is Mueller going to testify? And some of that is dependent upon negotiations. But I'm still not sure what Mueller's going to give them in front of the committee that's really going to change the public dynamic. And so the question, I think, is how long? I've just never seen Trump going to be impeached. He's not going to be removed. And so there's a lot of smoke, and you have the left part of the party that really wants to keep grinding at this. But I just don't see a scenario where, like, what's he going to say? Like, he already put in his report that he wasn't recommending obstruction. He just didn't make a decision on it. It was up to the Justice Department. And while there could be complaints about that, and they've interviewed Barr and Rosenstein is gone, at the end of the day, it was the Justice Department's call. We may disagree with it. You may hate the decision. You may like the decision. But I'm just not sure what Mueller's really going to add. It's going to be all that much different that's not in the report already.
Well, and the other thing is, and just my sense is, if Mueller really felt like he had something he needed to say, which sort of changed the public conversation on this, I would think he'd be trying to get in there as fast as he could
as possible
to get his voice heard. Like, this has been mischaracterized, or there are things that have been masked here that, you know, you really need to know. But we haven't gotten that sense of urgency from him.
No, and there were a couple of leaks here or there. And look, I'm no fan of Bill Barr necessarily, but at the end of the day, I think there's been a big argument of Democrats undercut just substantively, because however he characterized it when he came out, they eventually release the whole report for all intents and purposes, and Democrats can look at it. And so while there may be some quibbles with what he did and did he characterize it too early, that's mostly a PR fight. You said it, you know, you went too far in saying exonerating the president. You're acting like the president's lawyer. Those are all criticisms, and that's worthy of an op-ed maybe. I just don't know if that's worthy of impeachment, and I just don't see the public getting that upset because Bill Barr didn't take a hard enough line in some press conference 6 months ago.
Sean, your thoughts about the potential for Mueller testifying?
Well, he can testify. Some people say, well, he was hired by the Department of Justice. He owes a professional responsibility to them. They also say that there's an attorney-client privilege there, meaning that he has a responsibility to the client was DOJ and not put that information out. I still argue, and I believe he's a private citizen, and he probably could, if he really wanted to press the issue, go out and testify. But I think he's got plenty of cover not to do that. And if you're Mueller, why do you want to do that, right? Why do you did your report, you put it out, let people fight or quibble over how much of the redacted version gets out or not. But what's it in it for him to go out in front of Congress and then start the whole food fight up in the, you know, Belushi scene in the Animal House cafeteria? I mean, I just don't think there's any interest in Mueller personally or professionally to do that.
All right, we'll see. President Trump announcing last week yet another initiative on immigration, prioritizing highly skilled workers coming into the U.S. to get permanent residency over family unification for those who are already here. It doesn't appear that that's going to go anywhere in Congress. Sean, why do you think the president put this out last week?
Well, it's the Presidential Campaign Act of 2020 regarding immigration. I think, number one, it gives the president some cover that he took a little bit of a harder line that's beyond, quote unquote, the wall, which does not pull well with independents and a lot of other folks. It also gives Republicans, as I mentioned, there's 25 Republican senators that are defending their seats in this next election cycle. It gives them ability to pick and choose from parts of that that they like to defend. And honestly, chain migration is a real issue or a real problem for a lot of Republicans, and I think other people once they understand it. And there's nothing, I think, from a policy perspective, wrong or bad about prioritizing immigrants coming into this country. If you have a need for nurses, bring those immigrants into the country first and quickly. If you have a need for people who have certain skills in the tech side, bring those people in quickly. So it makes eminent amounts of good public policy sense, and it just broadens out from just the wall issue.
Matt, what do you think it means politically?
Yeah, the way it kind of landed with a thud. You had both sides. Clearly, Democrats don't trust or want to work with Trump on anything related to immigration,
and they don't want to give up on family unification.
No, they're certainly not going to give up. And that's been a sticking point for years with Democrats well before Trump. And you also have he did kind of aggravate a lot of the right as well, though, in that he really didn't reduce overall levels of immigration, and so that is still a concern. So he sort of, to me, with this, I get what he's trying to do, and I think having the debate might have been a smart one a couple of years ago to say, what are the types of immigrants we really want to have in here, as opposed he sort of made it, it felt like a much more xenophobic or kind of aggressive cultural stance that Trump had taken when he came into the White House. At least that's how it was characterized, and they seemed to be happy to have that. So I think a more nuanced debate over the types of skills and the types of immigration that the country has might have been an interesting discussion a couple of years ago. Clearly that train has left the station, certainly as far as Democrats go, but you still have a hardcore right that really wants to reduce immigration, period, and he didn't really address that much. So I'm not sure what he was trying to achieve here, because Trump is not a nuanced kind of guy, so I don't know if he's going to spend his campaign talking about the nuances of chain migration versus what types of skills we want from people from India versus Mexico versus Central America. So I'm not quite sure what his intellectual backing is in this one, but he does seem to have annoyed a lot of people on both sides of the political aisle.
Well, and as we see so often, he puts something out there and then sort of walks away from it, and it just sort of sits out there in space. The president's administration pulling nearly $1 billion in federal funding for high-speed rail here in California, which makes it very dicey as to whether even the leg from Bakersfield to Merced is going to be able to be constructed. You don't hear the enthusiasm for the project even among Democrats in California. Now that Governor Jerry Brown's out of office, this was really his pet project. Matt, where does this leave us on high-speed rail?
Leaves us with a lot of train trestles and maybe some white elephants and overpasses.
Yeah.
Maybe they can have some kind of names on them. I don't really know. This thing is a mess. Infrastructure tends to be a mess. This is what's always a challenge. Everyone talks about infrastructure. We want to build it for jobs in the future. But then when you start getting into it, especially when the government gets involved, and I'm originally from Boston, I remember the Big Dig.
Oh, yeah.
Which I actually do think has helped. In fairness, I think it actually has made a difference in terms of the traffic. The tunnels have worked. But that thing was a boondoggle. I mean, you're talking, went up 3, 4, 5, 6-fold. There was all kinds of corruption. And the same thing here. The government never sort of tells the truth. And I don't want to be overly sound like Sean here, but it always ends up being it's going to cost X, and it always costs 5 times more. This thing has been a mess from the beginning. My point is, I don't really know where this is going to go, because you have a Trump administration, especially if he wins re-election, that's not going to give in on this. And you have Newsom, who's really not that enthused about this because the numbers are just staggering to try to make this work.
But there are constituents. You've got organized labor.
Correct.
You've got construction interests.
Yeah.
So even though in the Central Valley this isn't doing well with residents or elected officials there, and clearly public sentiment in California has cooled to some degree. We don't know exactly how much. But there's still some real, proponents of this, Sean. Do you feel like it's one step from dead, or you think it's they'll just hang out, wait for a potential change in administrations?
Larry, I think it's like those firefighters that ran into the Ukrainian nuclear meltdown. They were irradiated and, you know, 30 days later, 90 days later, they died. So I think this thing died when Gavin Newsom gave his State of the State speech and said, right now, there simply isn't a path to get from Sacramento to San Diego, let alone from San Francisco to L.A. Specifically on the federal funding piece, there is actually contracts between the federal government and the state of California on what are requirements for this project, milestones, and the realistic chance of making project or progress on the project. And so what the feds agreed to was a train from L.A. to San Francisco. Now Newsom comes out and says it's going to be a train from Bakersfield to Merced. That's in violation of the contract. For all the questions I have about the Trump administration on a lot of policy issues, this one's pretty darn clear cut. And they're in violation of the contract, and they can not only pull back the $1 billion that's soon to come in the pipeline, but I think they could claw back the money that has already been put forward because basically it was almost fraudulently done. And this is not just my view. I've talked to a couple in preparation for our show today, a couple of former members of the board of the High Speed Rail Authority, and you know, they're dismayed insofar as what the state's doing now with regards to high-speed rail and the fact that they do think there is not just a leg to stand on, but they've got a tank to roll on to take the money back.
Well, and there's some potential political benefit here real quick, which is that, like, this thing is kind of a mess anyway, and Trump is very unpopular here. And I know Newsom and the Democrats haven't talked about this, but in a way, Democrats kind of own this, and it has been kind of a circus so far. They can sit there and say – they can just blame Trump.
Killed it.
This is his fault,
that
he's horrible. And I think it does give them some out here and something that is – it's hard to see how this thing gets really completed in the way that it was originally envisioned.
Matt Rodriguez, Sean Walsh joining us on Air Talk, political analysts with the biggest developments over the past week. There seems to be a difference in view of how to deal with Iran between – John Bolton and President Trump. We've got that as well as, of course, the trade impasse with China as well. Matt, your sense of these international issues and where we're going with both of those.
I think, well, they're two very different ones. China being a little more central to the president's kind of trade and economic philosophy. I think Iran, it's not totally, you know, it's always never clear exactly what is happening. And just with any administration, there's a lot that's not said. When you're in a bit of a conflict. My guess is this gets diffused, but it doesn't seem like Trump really wants to move forward with this. You know, again, he was a guy who came into office and was saying, we're going to get out of these dumb wars. I don't know. You know, I've always had some questions about Trump's judgment. I think a lot of us do. But he would not be dumb to sit there and to look back over the last 30 or 40 years and say, I don't want to get myself into some boondoggle with Iran and get dragged into some kind of quagmire here. So my sense is that he likes to be bellicose. And now we've kind of walked up to the line and he's saying, well, wait, maybe this is going a little bit too far. Because it's just a very that is a real difficult part of the world. There's Iraq was involved in it. You have also the Saudi and Sunnis. You have countries like Saudi Arabia that are interested in what's happening with Iran. And so it's a very complicated issue that I think Trump has sort of walked into and is now trying to get himself out of if he can.
Yeah. And Sean, as Matt was saying, it feels like we don't have the full picture of, you know, what the intelligence is that was, that led to the American response here. But do you have a sense that we're heading toward military conflict with Iran?
Well, I don't think so. I do have I did get a little bit of a briefing prior to coming on the program. And so, look, there is a not so cold war going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And so who is going to be the dominant player in the Middle East? So you've got the Iranians that are, trying to do sabotage on Saudi pipelines as well as Saudi ships. You've got the Saudis fighting a war and a very hot war in Yemen, of which the Iranians are supporting the Houthi rebels. So, you know, there's a lot of bad blood going on between those two countries. The Iranians have stepped up, at least if you believe the intelligence the Israelis have given us, including putting pretty significant missiles on some of their ships. A missile that could actually destroy a Arleigh Burke destroyer or a frigate. So what I understand is they were also arming some of their small swift boats with shoulder-fired missiles. You know, we monitor that very closely with drones as well as with satellites. Now, I think the Iranians, to de-escalate, I've been told, pulled those shoulder-fired missiles off of the folks that are on those boats. So they're de-escalating. And Trump himself has said many, many times he is not an interventionist. He's actually been trying to pull troops out of the world, and a lot of Republicans and even Democrats haven't liked that. So I think he has very little interest in committing troops to Iran, other than the fact that if they get out of line, maybe he'll smack them. And so I think that he was de-escalating with Bolton over the weekend, and then he made that comment, intemperate comment on the tweet saying, "We'll end you if you get out of line." So I think that's just Trumpism on the tweeting, and I don't think Trump has any interest in engaging in troop action against the Iranians.
John, what do you think about the ban on Huawei electronic equipment in the U.S., the Chinese manufacturer?
Well, everything that I've heard of in my own intelligence briefings that I've received at a number of conferences, as well as from folks in that community, that Huawei is the absolute poster child for embedding in all manner of technology in, stuff that will allow them to spy on the U.S. government, spy on U.S. politicians, spy on U.S. individuals. So I think that not only is it appropriate in this case, but I think it's a national security interest in the country. I'm not normally in favor of that kind of thing, but from everything I've heard and seen on Huawei, that I have no problems whatsoever with the president taking this action.
Yeah, and Huawei's really in around Europe, and this is not just an American issue, right? And I think America is trying to lead on this because there are real concerns as to what they're doing with their technology, with China kind of spreading throughout the world. So it's a real substantive issue. I think it also goes to show, this is sort of my own point of personal peak here, which I think that the Trump administration becomes such a circus in the media, it's become such a kind of reality show day to day. But something like Huawei, this is a serious issue. How are we going to react? And this is not just for now. It's not just for 6 months. This is a long term. What are we doing in terms of, you know, the Western powers versus Asia versus, you know, where is China going? You know, this type of technology, embedding it around the world, is a huge piece of what we're going to look like in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. So these are really, really substantive issues that are getting play. We're talking about it here. But it also takes a lot of a backseat to the sort of general kind of almost celebrity hate worship coverage that politics has become. But this is something we should really be watching. This actually matters to what the world's going to look like.
You know, it's funny because it seems to me, I know this is an oversimplification, but Democrats are very upset about Russia and meddling in elections and all the things that Russia tries to do to assert its influence. And Republicans, particularly through President Trump, much more concerned about China. It's interesting. It's like the two don't sort of speak to each other about relative risk here.
Yeah, and they're actually all, in some ways, they're all kind of interrelated in a way. It's all sort of a sort of an assault in some ways on our democracy, but also on kind of just the general, the way that you play the game, right? And China is, you know, there's a lot of problems with the way China tries to play their capitalist game as well as their political game, and they are trying to, you know, infiltrate themselves into a lot of societies in the same way that Russia is doing it more on the political side. China is doing it much on the economic and espionage and intellectual property side, as well as their own human rights issues. And so and if you think of it too, Democrats historically have not been as aggressive on Russia than, say, the Republicans, who their entire, you know, their modern.
Well, think of John McCain, all the things said against Russia.
Ronald Reagan. I mean, his entire, you know, the greatness of his presidency is based on the Soviet Union falling apart. So we are just in weird times, as we see. But these are real substantive issues that I think we've gotten away from in the country. But I think the Huawei thing is a big deal. It's a complicated deal and sometimes hard to understand, which isn't great for our daily news coverage, but it is an important one, not just for now, but for the future of, I think, global and geopolitical relations around the world.
We have two new Democratic candidates just announced. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced last week that he's joining. He made the announcement talking about it on Good Morning America last Thursday.
Right now, the federal government is not on the side of working people. And that's because Donald Trump is playing a big con on America. I call him Con Don. Every New Yorker knows he's a con artist. We know his tricks. We know his playbook. I know how to take him on. I've been watching him for decades. He's trying to convince working Americans he's on their side. It's been a lie from day one. So I believe I'll be able to show the kinds of things we have done here are what's needed all over this country so working people can live better.
And last Tuesday, Montana Governor Steve Bullock announced his candidacy. He speaks here with CNN State of the Union host Jake Tapper.
25 to 30% of my voters also voted for Donald Trump. And we need to make sure that we can win back places we lost. More than that, though, I've also, you know, I signed my last bill on Monday and announced on Tuesday that my whole time I've governed with a legislature that's about 60% Republican, yet we've been able to get progressive things done, like Medicaid expansion, like taking dark money out of our system. And if we need to bridge divides and make D.C. work.
We've been hearing about Steve Bullock from our frequent political commentator, Jack Pitney of Claremont McKenna College. Bullock, a former student of his. Bullock is a CMC graduate. So we have two new candidates. Sean, your thoughts about de Blasio, my understanding, is not necessarily beloved in New York City. What does he get out of announcing this candidacy?
You know, he's maybe like Donald Trump. He likes to see his name in print and he likes to see himself on page six. I don't know. He is not liked in New York. He's not liked in the state of New York in his many fights with Governor Cuomo. And I don't see how he gets much of a base and a lot of oxygen compared to the other candidates. With regards to Bullock, he seems to be trying to hang his hat on the fact that there's some geographic closeness to Iowa, and that'll help propel him early on into the race. I'm, you know, just like Eric Swalwell, who was born and raised in Iowa, I just don't see how the Iowa tiny little thread helps promote either one of those two folks. And again, the more you see of de Blasio, the less you like of de Blasio.
Matt, what's in this for de Blasio? Is it just sort of, as Sean's indicating, ego gratification, or is there a chance here to make some noise?
I think there's probably an element of that. There's always ego gratification for anyone who runs as president to some degree, sort of an inherent quality. He needs an office to run for. I think some of this has changed. You know, years ago, when you would run for president, there was some. It was sort of maybe an unspoken kind of barrier to entry, right? You had to have either had some type of political position, or you have to have some kind of threshold that you would cross. We've kind of passed that now. So I guess if you look at de Blasio, or if you say you're Bullock, and I don't necessarily agree with this, but you look at it and say every candidate now except for Biden has kind of, and Sanders, who are in kind of different category, they've kind of had a little bit of a bump and then they've fallen back. Right? Kamala got in, everyone's like, oh, Kamala, and now she's, you know, polling in single digits. What about Cory Booker? Well, Cory Booker's at 3%. Even Mayor Pete, who's having a kind of good run here, but he's still at 6 or 7% in the polls. So I guess you look at it and say, like, well, why don't I have my moment later, closer to the voting, as opposed to having my moment a year out? And maybe that's some of their calculation to say, look, I'm as qualified as anybody. Maybe my moment will come in the fall, and that's a better time to have the moment than to be Mr. April or Mr. May.
Speaking of Biden, he's, according to the latest Fox News poll, he's got a double-digit lead on Bernie Sanders. No one else is really close to Sanders. Mm-hmm. Are you surprised? I mean, maybe some of this is the announcement bump, but Biden has built on his lead.
Well, we've talked about, and not only has he got a double-digit lead on Sanders, he got a double-digit lead on the president in some of these states. You know, he's starting to creep up to 10-11% in Pennsylvania, and which I think is why you're seeing the White House starting to take a more aggressive tone towards Biden. Am I surprised? I don't know if I'm surprised. I think so much coverage now is sort of towards the kind of storm element of politics, but we tend to forget the voters. And there's still a large element of Democratic voters. There's white working class voters. There's like non-educated ones. Like, we've been told so much now that it's just college. It's college white voters are moving to Democrats and minority voters. And that's true. But African-American voters are typically not. They're not always going with the outsider. They're institutionalists. You still have a lot of white working class voters have moved to Trump. It doesn't mean all of them haven't. And there's been a long line of union and labor and white working class voters with Democrats for a long time. So am I surprised? No, because I think the beginning part of the race was everybody was racing to sort of go left and make it more of a cultural fight. Biden is talking a little bit more of sort of restoring something that's a little bit more stable. Does that mean it's going to hold? I don't know. And I think Sanders is running trying to sort of the same race that he ran before. So I don't know what – it's very difficult to run the exact same race two times in a row. And while Sanders has a committed base and money base, I don't see him doing a lot new than what he did before. And that is challenging in a presidential race.
And again, we'll see what happens when these debates, because things can change pretty dramatically. Someone becomes a star at the debates. Mm-hmm. Someone who's riding high ends up slipping up. And you can see some rather significant change, particularly with the ratings I would anticipate we're going to get for those actual debates. Coming up, we'll talk about whether a presidential candidate who's an atheist has any chance whatsoever. How far are we from someone who doesn't believe in God being electable? You're listening to Air Talk, back after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Washington Post columnist Max Boot, who's a frequent guest with us on Air Talk, about a week ago wrote a piece saying it's time for us to have an unapologetic atheist in the Oval Office. Max's piece begins, among the 21 candidates seeking the Democratic nomination, virtually every ethnic, religious, and sexual identity is represented. There's a gay man, six women, three African Americans, a Chinese American, multiple Catholics and Protestants, even a Hindu. But there's one conspicuous absence. Not a single candidate publicly identifies as an atheist. It's not to say they're all religious believers, but if they aren't, they're keeping it to themselves. Well, joining us to talk about what a hill that is to climb for an atheist to the presidency is a professor of political communications at USC, UC Berkeley, and Pepperdine, Dan Schnur, who was the founder of the USC LA Times statewide political poll. Dan, it's good to have you with us. I know this isn't something you've specifically polled on yourself, but I know you've looked at the polls about an atheist candidate. What do people say?
Well, Larry, first of all, thanks for having me on, and I think this is a fascinating topic. There was actually just a Gallup poll released on this very topic earlier this month, where they asked respondents about a variety of characteristics that would perhaps make them unwilling to vote for someone for president. An atheist ranked second of all those categories that would be unacceptable. 39% of Americans said that they would not vote for an atheist for president. As you might suspect, there's a pronounced partisan gap there. 28% of Democrats said that they would find that unacceptable, exactly twice that number. 56% of Republicans said that would not be acceptable. And the only category that outpolled, or I guess underpolled, atheist in this regard is the classification of socialist. 51% of Americans said they would not vote for a socialist for president. But finally, and then I'll stop, it's also worth noting that only a couple points behind or above atheist is the category older than 70. 39% of Americans said that they would not vote for a president who's an atheist. 37% they said they would not vote for a president older than 70, which is either bad news for Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and Joe Biden, or maybe we need to take these polls with somewhat of a grain of salt.
All right. Dan, and is this a pretty consistent result over the years? Because I don't know if socialist was included in the mix, but seems to me in the polls of earlier years I saw, atheist was like the most unpopular characteristic for a candidate.
Well, there's polling information, not just on politics, as you might suspect, Larry, but when people self-identify in terms of their own religious beliefs or absence of beliefs. The polling is all over the map on the term atheist, primarily because of the way the question is asked and the way the term is defined. Most polls show well less than 10% of Americans identify themselves as atheist. Others show it higher depending on the definition. Interestingly, the fastest growing category of religious affiliation are so-called nones, people who do consider themselves to believe in God, but have disassociated themselves from any major religion. That classification also has a significant partisan gap. Democrats are much more likely to say that they do not affiliate with a major religion than Republicans do.
But it doesn't necessarily mean they don't believe in God, because those nones, as you describe it, they typically do believe in God.
Exactly right. They very specifically differentiated themselves from atheists or even agnostics in simply saying that they were not affiliated with a major religion.
All right. Love to hear your analysis of where things are at with American voters being willing to accept an atheist candidate. Sounds like we're a long way from that, at least according to what respondents to polls tell us. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Sean, given that so few Americans are atheists, the only way this would change if you had much higher percentage of people who didn't believe in God?
Well, Larry, Dan Schnur is the equivalent of the Wayne and Garth in Wayne's World. When he comes on the program, I fall to my knees and say I'm not worthy. So who be it me to contradict what he actually says, because he is a brilliant, brilliant analyst. But I do think that for with regards to atheists, part of the issue there is most people, when they see an atheist folks come out, at least in the public context, they want to change the currency in the United States, wipe out "In God We Trust." They don't want you to stand up for the national anthem or the flag, "One Nation Under God." So, if a person was an atheist and ran and didn't wear that on their shirt sleeves, I'm not so sure that that would be as much of a problem as it has been in the past. And I would venture a guess that half of the people running in the Democratic primary, they may have been born into a religion based on their family, but they probably have virtually no religion or religious identification at all. So long as you don't wear it on your shirt sleeve, I think you're fine.
Well, and you have candidates and presidents who go to church but don't necessarily talk much about their faith. Seems to me the last president who regularly talked about his religious faith was Jimmy Carter. That was, that was a central aspect of his identity, was as a born-again Christian.
And has been throughout his life. You know, he's talked about it since, written several books on the subject. I think the challenge with saying you're atheist, and Sean alluded to it, but it's one thing to be religious, which I think the country's been moving away from, and people are moving away from institutions for a while now. So that, I think, is one thing. It's another thing to say I'm atheist. It just feels much different.
It's much more in your face.
It's much more, and it's aggressive, and it's a difficult thing to sell because even though there are fewer people who may be in an organized religion, and that has been changing certainly with younger people, when you say you're an atheist, it's a pretty core belief, obviously. Like, what are we doing here? And God put us here. And so when you're telling enormous amounts of Catholics, Muslims, Christians, Jews, you're sort of essentially saying their belief system is not. And you can say, I respect their decisions. I'm not. But it's a difficult. You'd have to be a very good communicator to be able to say that in a way that wouldn't say, like, your entire belief system and your existential view of the world is invalid. And that's a hard thing to that's a hard needle to thread. Maybe somebody could do it, but that's challenging.
Well, so if you have, and Max in his column mentions, you know, Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. who is culturally Jewish, but I don't believe that he's observant.
Right.
Yeah. So, but candidates get asked about their religious faith and all. So can you, Matt, can a candidate who's not a religious person sort of avoid that or find have finesse around that question?
I think it's hard. I just think it's hard to do, because even within the Democrats, because we're talking Democrats here, right? I mean, in general, Republicans seem a little bit more overtly religious, or at least a lot do. They're religious, right? But even in the Democratic Party, if you want to go down south and work with a lot of African Americans, the church is the hub of that community. So it would be just from a pure, raw, crass political perspective, I think it would be difficult to go down and say, well, how am I going to campaign in South Carolina? How am I going to go down to the South? How am I going to go to some inner city areas? Because a lot of the social and political hub of those communities is the church. And so I think it would be difficult both to communicate that and also to say, where does my moral belief come from? Where does my where do my values come from? And I just think that's just harder probably by nature to communicate as an atheist, because religion or some kind of belief in some kind of higher power gives you some grounding to say, well, here's what it's based on. There's got to be something to base my philosophy on.
And atheists can do that. I mean, certainly people who've written about this have a very sophisticated framework for describing where morality comes from in the absence of belief of God. But good luck communicating that on the campaign trail.
That's my point, because that's a complicated and nuanced, and complication and nuance that's a very difficult thing in politics, especially when there's going to be some undercurrent of, well, what does this person really believe? Or, and that is challenging.
Yeah, and the sort of, messaging that would go on beneath the surface from other candidates that this person is not trustworthy, mm-hmm. because she or he doesn't believe in God.
Yeah.
That would be part of the messaging. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back with more from Sean and Matt in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're using op-ed writer The Washington Post Max Boot's recent column as a point of departure to talk about whether an atheist would ever be a viable presidential candidate. As we just heard from Dan Schnurr, the most recent Gallup poll showing the second biggest obstacle to someone being considered suited for the presidency is being an atheist. 12 percentage points below being a socialist. So you've got, socialist is considered the biggest negative. Being an atheist, the second biggest. The third biggest negative is a candidate being 70 years of age or older. Let's take a listener call from Reed in Santa Monica. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, I've been an atheist for most of my life, and I've noticed that there's a big difference in how people react versus, when they find out I'm an atheist, as opposed to when I actively talk about it. People tend to react a lot more negatively if I claim atheism versus if they just find out in conversation that I don't believe.
Yeah, it's interesting. So they assume if you volunteer it, that it's sort of a bigger part of your identity, or how are they perceiving it differently?
I think they perceive it as an attack on their faith for whatever reason. I'm not sure this is universal, but I've noticed that a lot of people are like, oh, well, why are you an atheist? Why would you tell me that?
Yeah. So as though they have to defend themselves. That's fascinating. So do you usually don't bring it up unless there's sort of a natural point in the conversation?
Yeah, I tend to not bring it up. Asked anymore. Certainly when I was younger, I was a lot more forthcoming about it, and I found people didn't react well to that.
Do you one of the things that we were just talking about is a challenge for a candidate would be the portrayal of them by opponents that they're somehow not as morally trustworthy in not believing in God. And the positions that they take would be framed by opponents as, oh, you believe that just because you don't believe we're created by God. You don't. And this would be something a candidate would have to deal with who's atheist. Do you think there's any way around that for an atheist candidate?
I've noticed that a lot in my interactions with people, and I find that the only way to get around that is through a fairly lengthy explanation on biological morality. And so I think that for a presidential candidate, when you're forced to, reduce everything to sound bites, it would be very difficult to move past that that argument that a lot of religious people make that an atheist cannot be moral inherently.
Yeah, because you kind of have to scaffold that argument, right? It's not just immediately self-evident. And people aren't familiar with the reasoning behind morality coming without God. So, yeah, that you just got a built-in challenge. Reed, I appreciate it very much. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let me go back to Dan Schnur, professor of political communications at SC Berkeley and at Pepperdine. Can you imagine building a campaign around an atheist and how you would convey trustworthiness and morality?
It would be very difficult to do so, but I would offer you this, Larry. There was a time in American history when building a campaign for a Catholic candidate would have faced similar obstacles. Over the last few years, we've seen a remarkable rise in the number of Americans who'd be willing to accept a gay or lesbian candidate as president. So poll numbers, of course, as you and most of your listeners know, Larry, are snapshots in time. And at this particular juncture, it is something that would be met with great distrust and discomfort. What both Matt Rodriguez and Sean Walsh know, because they do or did this for a living, is an essential part of every candidate's vocabulary is the term, just like you. I'm a working mother, just like you. I'm a small business owner, just like you. Even Donald Trump says, I'm fed up with all the Washington elites just like you. And the amount of time and space that your listener correctly pointed out, it would take for someone using the term atheist to describe themselves, the amount of time it would take them to describe to a voter that they are just like them, even given the natural impulse in response, would be pretty considerable. And at least in the foreseeable future, it's hard to see a candidate attempting that kind of a jump.
We're talking with Dan Schnur, also with us, Sean Walsh, and Matt Rodriguez about what the viability for an atheist candidate would be with Americans holding such strong views. Matt, do you know of any, have we had any, say, European leaders who are openly atheist? Or I'm not knowledgeable enough about European politics to have anyone come to mind.
Yeah, I can't think of any, but that doesn't mean it hasn't existed. Yeah. I mean, I think—
Because you could see it there first before it was here,
I think,
right?
For sure you would see it there first. And I think that you—and you've seen—look, you've seen a diminishment, if that's the word. You've seen a decreasing of the importance of religion, I think, in some ways in public life. They don't talk about it as much. I mean, as Dan mentioned, I mean, look, a big part of the 1960 campaign was Kennedy's Catholicism, and what would that mean in terms of making a decision as president of the United States that might have contradicted what the tenets of the Pope said, or so. These are not things that are new, and I do think in some ways, you know, we probably have more fertile ground now than we ever have had before for someone who certainly doesn't emphasize religion as much. I mean, even Barack Obama did not. I mean, there were other presidents who are much more into the symbolism. Carter, not just in terms of his belief system, but even Reagan, they were going to church much more often. It was a big part of every single Sunday. Obama did not make that a big part of his presidency, although obviously his faith and belief system was still there. So it has decreased over time. I just think atheism just feels different. It does feel like a more, as we mentioned, like aggressive or almost judgmental position. And I'm not saying that's fair.
Yeah.
But from a perception point of view, I think that would be there. And I think that makes it so much more difficult, while religion and some of that overt morality is not as in public life as it used to be.
Yeah.
Sean. You asked if Europeans on religion. Well, two of our longtime enemies, or at least our adversaries in the Cold War, China and Russia, their official state religion was no religion. It was basically atheism. So, you know, you had a battle going on for multi-generations with regards to, you know, free enterprise and, you know, free religion in the United States, and communism and no religion and state-sanctioned atheism in those societies. So I would wonder if that has some sort of impact on the voters psychologically, particularly voters that are of, you know, baby boomer generation.
Apparently, former French President François Hollande is an atheist. Mm. I wasn't aware of that. I guess there have been a couple of Italian presidents who've been Italy.
Vatican. I rethink my entire position here. If someone from Italy get elected.
Hey, gentlemen, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Dan Schnur joining us, Sean Walsh, Matt Rodriguez as well. You can share your comments about whether we would see in our lifetimes an atheist president of the United States on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Coming up in the next hour, your favorite television series finale of all time, Game of Thrones, came to a close last night. Want to hear what you thought about it, too. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're going to talk momentarily about the greatest finales of a series in television history. Last night, Game of Thrones with its final episode. We don't have the viewing figures yet. Safe to say millions of Americans tuned in for the finale. Coming up later this hour, though, we'll talk with the man behind Pandora's Music Genome Project, Nolan Gasser, his new book, Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. Why do you like the kind of music that you do? We'll explore that later this hour. But first, Game of Thrones coming to a close less than a week after The Big Bang Theory ended its lengthy run on CBS. There have been so many classic series that ended not with an incidental final episode, but with a carefully crafted one to try and bring the chapter of the characters to a close. Let's go back to the final episode of Friends, as the group says goodbye to the iconic purple apartment that belonged to Monica Geller's grandmother and housed all of the friends at one point or another in the series' life. Most recently here, Monica, Courtney Cox, lived there with her husband, Chandler Bing, played by Matthew Perry, and their newborn adopted twins. And they're finally moving out in the final episode.
Okay, please be careful with that. It was my grandmother's. Be careful. Thank you. If that falls off the truck, it wouldn't be the worst thing.
Wow.
I know. Seems smaller somehow.
Is it? always been purple?
Look around, you guys. This was your first home. And it was a happy place, filled with love and laughter. But more important, because of rent control, it was a friggin' steal.
From Friends, the final episode. With us to talk about the best finales in the history of television is business editor of Variety, Cynthia Littleton. Cynthia, good to have you with us again. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Larry.
Last night, let's start with Game of Thrones, and we're going to do our best to avoid spoilers. I know most fans of the series probably built Sunday night around seeing the final episode as it aired on HBO, but for those who recorded it and are planning to watch it on DVR later, let's try not to reveal anything that would spoil the experience. What did you think about the final episode?
I mean, I personally, as a viewer, as a fairly casual Game of Thrones viewer, which is kind of heresy among the big TV aficionados, I thought it was satisfying. I thought it wrapped up most of the key characters and gave you a clear idea of where they were, their direction of where their stories would go in the future. I thought it left enormous doors open for coming back. There are no shortage of places and characters that could be picked up with, you know, in a few years' time if everybody decides that that's a good idea. You know, the reaction has been pretty strong out there, as you would expect, given the megaphone of social media. Lots of people are parsing every decision, lots of criticism about, well, this character's motivation didn't track with the rest of that character's journey on the show. So there's inevitably going to be a lot of that. If there wasn't, that would be concerning to HBO. It's a sign that some people cared so deeply about this show and the characters.
Hard to bring a lengthy series to a close when you feel like you know those characters so well. I go back to another HBO series, The Sopranos, which left the ending open-ended, implying that something bad was going to be happening to Tony and or his family as they were having dinner together. But they're a very conscious decision by showrunner David Chase to leave it open-ended to the viewer and not to have a final scene of violence or avoidance of violence. There's a lot of criticism of Sopranos and viewers who wanted some sense of closure that the finale didn't provide.
I mean, this is true. David Chase to this day is constantly peppered with questions about what did you mean, you know, what did you mean with that finale? Now that time has passed, he's often asked, do you regret the finale? And to his credit, he has the courage of his convictions and, you know, he regrets nothing. He birthed that show. He took it out the way he saw fit.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Nick in Palm Springs wants to mention what's one of the most shocking finales of any television series in history. Nick, go right ahead.
Hey, Larry. Well, after that buildup, it may seem counterintuitive, but, you know, we talk about the Game of Thrones and Sopranos and these big, meaty series, but the one that always comes back to me is the second Newhart, where they pulled that surprise off, where Suzanne Plachette shows up at the end of the episode, if you recall it or if you know.
Yeah. Oh, I do remember.
And I think for a light, frothy sitcom to be able to have kept that under wraps, you know, I mean, there was no reason you would expect something like that from a previous series to then show up. And it just always stuck with me, and I love watching the clip even on YouTube still to this day.
It's such a shock, such a twist ending, which pulls the premise of the entire series out from under you. Now, if you haven't seen it, so the second series Bob Newhart stars in is just called Newhart. Dick Loudon, who's the character that he plays in this final episode, he's hit in the head with a golf ball, and then it cuts to Newhart, still the star, but playing the character of his previous series, psychologist Dr. Robert Hartley. And Nick mentioned Suzanne Plachette, who played his wife in that earlier series. And he's in bed with Suzanne Plachette, and they wake up, and it's all a dream. The whole second series was all a dream.
And the subtlety of it, too, they went so far as to recreate the set from the first series. The bed sheets were even, you know, the same sort of plaid that were sort of a 1970s look. And they just had it all done, and Suzanne Plachet looks at him like, what are you talking about, Bob? It was perfect.
It was remarkable. And even the look of the film was just perfectly matched the earlier series. We're talking about the end of the CBS series, Newhart. Cynthia Littleton, you remember that close?
I do. And it was, you know, it was so unusual because, you know, to pull that off, you had to have a show and a personality in Bob Newhart who had been fortunate enough to have a previous show that was beloved and had a long run. You know, to pull that off, you had to have the establishment of the Bob Hartley and Emily Hartley, played by Suzanne Plachet. You had to have that relationship established, and then you had to have just the good fortune. All those years later, I believe Newhart ended in 1990, all those years later, to have Suzanne Plachet be game to come back. You know, oftentimes on shows, there's no love lost between stars, and there can be chilly relations, but that was just the case of the stars aligning, and the inspiration to make that happen.
Brilliant idea.
I believe their showrunner has said that it was something that came to him as they knew a year or two out that they knew that the Newhart show was coming to an end, that it was an idea that kind of sprung, that grew slowly, and when they realized that they could pull it off, it would be harder in today's world with social media.
Yeah, because they kept it quiet.
Somebody might have seen Suzanne Plachet going into the driving onto the studio lot. It just seems like one of those things that could happen and have that kind of impact because we were, you know, living in a certainly a simpler time of communications.
Miriam Glendora seconding the Newhart finale is totally unexpected. And also, she's a big fan of the ending from MASH. Let's listen to that. This finale of MASH, the only non-Super Bowl among the top 10 most watched TV broadcasts of all time. In the final scene of the series, Hawkeye Pierce, Alan Alda, and B.J. Honeycutt, Mike Farrell, bid a heartfelt farewell to one another as their time together at the 4077 comes to an end.
Look, I know how tough it is for you to say goodbye, so I'll say it. Maybe you're right. Maybe we will see each other again. But just in case we don't, I want you to know how much you've meant to me. I'll never be able to shake you. Whenever I see a big pair of feet or a cheesy mustache, I'll think of you.
Whenever I smell month-old socks, I'll think of you.
And the next time somebody nails my shoe to the floor.
Yeah, when somebody gives me a martini that tastes like lighter fluid.
I miss you.
I'll miss you a lot. I can't imagine what this place would have been like if I hadn't found you here.
Mike Farrell, Alan Alda, the finale of MASH, and they're a natural closure point with the Korean War winding down to an end. What's your favorite series finale, or which one were you eagerly anticipating that simply didn't live up to what you'd hoped it would be? 866-893-KPCC. Priscilla in Glassell Park says, as someone who read all the Game of Thrones books, I think it's amazing that the series ending honored the original material and the beginning of the series, going back to the Starks and the symbolism of the throne itself being the true villain. That's Priscilla. You can share what you thought of the Game of Thrones series finale. Was it satisfying or not? I just ask as much as possible to please avoid giving away any turns at the end of that for those who've recorded it and are planning to see it in the coming few days. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Max in Manhattan Beach says, finales have to live up to the buildup of the actual show, not feel contrived or like the series is rushing to wrap it up. Max says, I think, unfortunately, Game of Thrones felt a little contrived and a little rushed. 866-893-KPECC. KPECC. You can share your thoughts about which ones that for you are the most satisfying, which ones not. One that is a masterpiece, and I've seen in a number of stories covering best finales of all time, the HBO series 6 Feet Under, Alan Ball's series, which was so beautifully written, and death was a centerpiece of that series. And in the final episode, they resolve what happens to the funeral parlor that the family owns in Los Angeles. But then they take each of the principal characters of the series and fast forward through their lives and take you to each of their deaths. A very, very gutsy close to that series by Alan Ball. Cynthia Littleton, what did you think of the 6 Feet Under close?
Well, that one was very just startling, and in I think in the best way, when it aired some years ago now, it seemed very I think to the point of the previous caller that the best finales seem to honor the totality of the show by not going off in some wildly different creative direction or suddenly turning one character by 90 to 180 degrees just to serve a plot point. That is the stuff that tends to be frowned upon. In 6 Feet Under, it was just such a around that time jumps were not as common that you would see. You see them now fairly frequently as a plot device in shows, but back then it was that finale also, you almost thought that it was going to end at a certain point, and then you got into this beautiful sort of montage scene that gave you the sense of where each of the characters were going. It was a beautiful piece of music that played over. It was just a very stirring way to bring the show to an end after a lot of potboilery elements had been resolved or at least addressed, to the satisfaction of fans that had invested a number of seasons in the show. So yes, I think 6 Feet Under still ranks very high in terms of creativity, but honoring all that had come before.
Chris tweets, the Sopranos began with Tony having panic attacks. It ended with Tony cured, but the audience panicking when the screen went blank. Genius ending. That's Chris tweeting at Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We'll take Carol Ann and Lisa's calls coming up. They have a couple of other series we haven't yet mentioned. They want to tout their finales as among the best. We'll be back in 1 minute. Johnny Mandel's theme for MASH. Probably a record won't be broken for the most watched finale in television history. Huge, huge audience for MASH when it went out. The 9th most watched program in the history of television. Everyone above it is the Super Bowl. That's how big this series was. We're asking you your favorite finale of a series, or one that you were really, really looking forward to and just didn't deliver. I'd say Seinfeld was that for me. I'm a huge fan of Seinfeld, and the final episode just didn't quite work for me. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Variety's Cynthia Littleton is with me. Carol Ann, in Torrance, your favorite finale.
Oh, Larry, just hearing the MASH theme hit me in the heart. But I think one of my very favorites was the Mary Tyler Moore closing.
It was so inspired.
That ensemble cast was just so universally, fantastically talented. And every single actor in that show was a jewel, and each character was a gem.
It was so in the feeling of the show, Carol Ann, to have every new ownership take over the station and everybody be fired. It gave great comedic opportunity, but also something serious that undergirded the comedy that came out of it. And I love that episode.
What sticks in my mind is the hug of how they're moving from one end of the station to the other you know, giant hug.
While they're still arms around each other. Yeah, it was that was a very funny scene and very telling. That series was sure lightning in a bottle. Let's talk with Lisa in Northridge. Lisa, what's your favorite finale?
I'd have to say that one of my absolute favorite series finale was Parks and Rec. I think they did a really good job setting up the finale with the time jump in the final season and then finishing it out with the continuing time jumps in the final episode to like show where everyone had gone and, you know, where their life had taken them with their decisions and from being in Parks and Rec. And I really also kind of love the little bit of the ambiguous ending of exactly the final fate career-wise of Leslie and or Ben.
And sometimes it's hard to hit the sort of the right balance between poignancy because over a period of time, one develops an emotional attachment to these characters, and there's a sadness that you're not going to see new stories with them. But the other hand, you know, with a comedy like Parks and Rec, it's really got to be funny. It can't all be about sort of the, you know, melancholy farewell. And you, do you feel, Lisa, that it hit the right note?
Absolutely. I think ending with Terry Larry's funeral, some of that part was really funny. I think they did a really good job of really setting up, keeping it funny, but really giving everyone very satisfying conclusions.
Lisa, I appreciate it so much. From a Parks and Rec fan, David in La Habra, you want to talk about Three's Company's closer?
Yes, it was something that I still to this day have not seen, if it, at the least often. The way Three's Company ended was at Jack's Bistro, if I remember right. And when the credits were done rolling, Three's a Crowd followed right behind it in the credits, literally. So Three's Company ending was followed by Three's a Crowd, which was him, his fiance, and her father pretty much starring in the show.
So they just rolled it from one to the other. And that's yeah, you got a built-in big audience for a hit series that's closing. Why not launch something new to come out of it? Cynthia, we have any other examples like Three's Company where they leveraged that final episode that way?
You know, in terms of directly the final episodes, I'm racking my brain. That does seem like an old school move. I think there's an understanding now that people, you know, networks, they milk the heck out of finale seasons. You know, the pattern now has been to, you know, to let people know that this is going to be the final season and then market the heck out of that. We saw that obviously with Game of Thrones. We've seen that from CBS this year with The Big Bang Theory, which just wrapped its run this past Thursday. And I'm really racking my brain. There probably is, you know, going back decades, but off the top of my head, I feel like
I can't. Yeah,
I think networks would see that as a little crass right now, and unless you had something that was so perfectly set up. But even in the case of The Big Bang Theory, CBS did have a spinoff called Young Sheldon, but that launched two seasons ago, so it kind of already had its roots established. There was, though, in Thursday's episode of Young Sheldon, there was a nod to the Big Bang Theory finale.
Yeah.
Young Sheldon is a prequel, and the character had a vision of things in the future that related to the Big Bang finale, so that was kind of a nice tie-in. But directly like that, with the Three's Company example, which, that's good. That's pulling it out of your hat.
Yeah, that is.
I can't think of anything analogous.
Yeah. Ivy wants to comment. You share my view about the Seinfeld finale. What was it bothered you about that close?
You know, it's funny because I love Larry David, and I've seen every episode of Seinfeld maybe 5 or 6 times a piece.
Yeah, me too.
So I felt like I knew the characters really well, and it bothered me that they seemed somewhat out of character. Like, they were shallow people and selfish people, but they weren't nasty, mean people. And so I thought them ignoring the plight of this guy who is getting robbed just completely upended everything that I felt like I knew about their characters. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they seemed like different people to me. I had the same. So I just assumed Larry David was doing something that I didn't understand because he's so brilliant. I just figured somehow I missed. There was something he's revealing about the characters that I hadn't seen, and that was on me. But I have to say it was not satisfying for me either.
Yeah, I don't think that. I think he just wanted to have them have some sort of recompense and bring everybody back who had been so popular throughout the series. And that was the only way he could think of to do it. But he ended up kind of missing the mark with the character's behavior.
Yeah, Cynthia, Seinfeld's finale was one that seemed to generally arrive with a thud. And what do you think are the reasons for that?
I think one thing to remember is that Larry David, at the time the Seinfeld finale aired, Larry David had been off the show for a couple of years. So maybe part of it was he hadn't been living with those characters as intently as he would had he been the showrunner in the final. I believe it was the final two or three seasons that he was not technically the showrunner, though he did come back for the final episode. It's a, you know, given the high quality of so much of Seinfeld, given the esteem that Larry David is held in by comedy writers, that one still, you know, almost 20 years later, more than 20 years later, just remains a head scratcher as to how they could have gotten it so off. Although on some level, you know, as a viewer, you say, okay, I'm investing in this show. I'm going along on the ride. This is how they decided that the ride, you know, that this particular ride had to end. But I think I'm in agreement with the callers that it was just a surprising miss from a show that otherwise was, you know, had so many stellar moments.
Well, and given Larry David's greatness, he can have a whiff. That's all right. And I think he still considers that to be, it was, I think, executed the way that he intended. Evan in San Clemente, I understand you were the star of a reality show in its final episode. Share your story, please.
Well, no, Larry, I listen to you when I can, and I didn't so much call because of my particular show, but I was on Joe Millionaire from Fox, and we had, you know, reality television is the redheaded stepchild of TV, the way I look at it. But we did have quite large numbers for our season finale, which I think were in the 40 million range. But it was funny because I was a big fan of Frasier, which I don't know if you watched.
Oh yeah. Huge fan of Frasier. Yeah.
And at the time, which in 2004, I was working as a game show host for the Game Show Network. And we were touring around. I was touring around with Chuck Woolery, and it just so happened that the week of the finale for Frasier, we were in Seattle.
Great. And the city's going nuts.
I watched the finale where that show was supposed to be based around, you know, Seattle. I was at the Westin Hotel on the Thursday night when it aired, watching the season finale, and it was just neat to say, you know, that hey, I was
I'll bet
where that was based off of. Did you like the season finale?
The series finale for Frasier? I did. I thought it was well done. It was a little wistful. I thought it was done. It's funny because now they're talking about potentially bringing Frasier back again. We'll see if that happens. But I wouldn't be surprised given the reboots or revivals of series. Evan, thanks very much. Evan Marriott, star of Joe Millionaire, being in a final finale himself. Grace in Culver City said she was disappointed in Star Trek The Next Generation because it didn't feature some key characters that who appeared throughout the series. It left a lot of open endings. It's funny because there was also a listener in Long Beach. Let me see if I can find him. Calvin in Long Beach was not happy with Star Trek Deep Space Nine's ending. Said it was very disappointing. You didn't know whether Captain Sisko died or not. It just left you hanging there. Let's see what other comments we have. Oh, David in Universal City, The Fugitive finale. David Janssen, starring this before the feature film, The Fugitive, in which Harrison Ford starred. David said the ultimate finale, whole series was waiting to see if the real one-armed man who was the killer would be caught. And he was in the final episode. That's back when everyone watched the same few television channels. And Cynthia, my recollection is that The Fugitive at the time, I think that set the ratings record before it was broken later by MASH.
It was, you know, I can't say I remember this firsthand, but I have seen the original Fugitive series, and it is fantastic. It's suspenseful. It's taut. It has the cat and mouse element, and there are so obviously it ran, I believe it ran, the original series ran 3 seasons, and while, you know, there are encounters between the law enforcement official who's chasing David Janssen's character, there, you know, there are encounters, and there's, you know, times when you think, oh my God, how could this person have eluded capture for the 15th time? The show overall is really well done, and the finale is so good. I remember the last line. I guess I'm a little reluctant to spoil it for people, just in case they might want to go seek it out. But the writing and the voiceover last line was so good. It just put the entire series into perspective, and it is, for a show that was very often dark, it was a fairly you know, positive ending for the character that had been through hell and back.
I loved the road
finale.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Sandy. It sort of turned the road trip show on its head, because of course he's on the run, but he goes all throughout the United States, and so he gives you a different sense of place. It's sort of like the dark Route 66, so to speak, series that had predated it. Nina in View Park. Hey, Nina, real quickly, you actually champion a series finale that was pretty generally panned. You liked the close of Lost.
I did, Larry. I mean, I can't say that I loved it, but I would agree with your guest, Cynthia, who says, you know, oftentimes you are so vested in a show. And I just thought the quality of the writing for Lost, the depth and the diversity of the characters was so incredible that I was willing to accept, although I wasn't thrilled. I was like, what? They really are dead. But the romantic part of me was so happy with the two characters, Jack and Kate, finally, Kate finally declaring her love. I remember I turned to my husband and I got all teary-eyed and I said, man, I've been waiting 5 years for her to say that to him.
So you got the payoff from that. Nina, thanks so much in View Park. John in Montrose says his favorite Saint Elsewhere, totally unexpected finale. And Robin Glendale said, I was a kid during the final episode of Cheers when Sam Malone closed down the bar. Very poignant moment for a comedy and in TV history. And he didn't end up with Diane Chambers. She didn't end up with him as she returned for that final episode, and one didn't know what the result would be. Cynthia Littleton, Variety Business Editor, thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Thank you, Larry.
Enjoyed it. Coming up, what is it about our musical taste? What influences it? What are the factors that lead us to seek out the kinds of music that we do? We'll talk about that right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Hurdy's. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We all love music, right? But what are the reasons that we love specific types of music? Best estimates are that we spend about 15 hours a week listening to music. Much of that isn't our choice. We're in public places where music plays in the background, but a fair amount of it we're able to control, either driving in our car, listening to home sound systems, or with our earbuds in as we walk around. But why do we choose the type of music that we do? After all, it's not necessarily predictive that you're a given age that you listen to a particular genre or a particular array of artists. Understanding our musical taste is at the heart of musicologist Nolan Gasser's work. He was the consultant who put together Pandora Radio's Music Genome Project, as chief musicologist at Pandora since it was founded in 2000. He's a musicologist with a doctorate from Stanford, and he himself, a composer, pianist, and musicologist. Nolan's new book is Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. Nolan, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Larry. Thank you.
I appreciate it. So what do we understand, first of all, about why we are generally attracted to music? What happens in the pleasure center of the brain, or what seems to be the thing that makes us drawn to the sounds of music?
Well, obviously, it's a very rich question. It's one that's why the book is so big. There's so much to talk about in terms of why it is that we all gravitate to music in such a deep and profound way. we come hardwired. Our brains are really music processing machines. We can not only sort of process the sound, but we can make sense of it. We understand it as from a syntactical, from a semantical, from an emotional standpoint. And so we really are just, sponges waiting to hear the kinds of music that will be part of our upbringing, those scales and rhythms and meters that form our sort of cultural musical diet and language. And as we grow up, that becomes more fine-tuned with the subcultures that we grow up in, which give us access to some kinds of music, but perhaps not to others. And of course, our own personalities play a role, our sort of emotional capacity, our personalities, the things that we're drawn to will be the reason why we love one Beatles song more than another, while our best friend likes the opposite. So it's a many splendored thing.
And why do we think that individuals are most drawn to music from their formative years, and that influence for most people, I think, stays with them throughout their life? Now, they may evolve in the artists that they listen to. They may open themselves up to new evolutions of music, but there's something about the power of the formative years and the music that one listens to then. Why?
Well, it really comes down to our becoming individuals in our teens and in our 20s, where we all seek to sort of break away from the limits of our parents and our family to forge our own identity. And because music is so indelibly part of our identity and who we are in our cultural sort of being, that musical language, those musical artists and styles and genres that we gravitate to in those critical years of our teens become the soundtrack of our independence. And so, again, music has such a capacity to forge emotion at a deep level, as you talked about, in our brains, are sort of the pleasure centers of our brain, and the amygdala and the limbic system are tied in with the pulse of music and the cerebellum. So it's so vibrant in us that music creates emotion, so that when we're forging that unique identity in those pivotal years, it just becomes so critical to our sense of who we are. And as we grow older, we obviously find new kinds of music, but still we all can think about those events, those people, those experiences that we had when we were young that forge, who we are. And music is, again, that soundtrack. So it's why when older adults are facing memory issues of Alzheimer's and dementia, they can often not remember who their own family members are or what they did yesterday. But you start playing a song that they knew when they were young and they can sing every note, every lyric. It's just an example of how music is just in sort of so closely intertwined with our sense of self.
Do you think it serves an evolutionary adaptive purpose, that there is, aside from the positive, the sense of well-being or comfort or excitement that music can provide, some cases even ecstatic experience that music heightens, is there some sort of a survival purpose or benefit it conveys?
Well, it's a great question. It's one that I explore in a fair bit of detail. So the book really, just to back up just a tad, the book sort of approaches musical taste from two different standpoints, from a purely musical one, because certainly one of the reasons why we gravitate to the music that we love and away from the music that we don't has to do with what's going on under the hood of the music. That's what I did at Pandora as the chief architect of the Music Genome Project, figuring out how do we create a framework of analysis for these different species of music across all of the parameters, melody, harmony, rhythm, because that's certainly part of why we love music. But sort of interlacing in the musical discussions are these extra musical interludes. And it's kind of like a mystery novel. I'm trying to start at the 10,000-foot view and penetrate down to the ground floor of why we as individuals love music. And so one of the early interludes is on the role of music in evolution and archaeology. And there's, not surprisingly, when you get a bunch of scholars dealing with, sort of difficult questions, there's often fierce debates. And one of them is, was music an adaptive trait that helped us to evolve and survive? I call it the big fat cheesecake debate, and you can read about why that is. But the idea is, you know, did music, for example, precede language, or did music just sort of take a hold of those brain processes of language and sort of sort of use them almost like a parasite? Is our love of music just a reaction to other aspects of our identity? Some people would argue that the way that music can bond us together, the power that music can bring us together when we all sing collectively or we all feel the beat together, that is an example of how music plays an indelible role in defining culture writ large. And so I think that the bottom line, for me anyway, is that yes, musicality, if not music per se, is part of what helped us to survive and become human. And that's why in all of the manifestations, music is so important, because it's hardwired into our very identity as humans.
It's fascinating for me. I look at my taste in music, and it's not really at all intellectual. It's very visceral. It's very physical. When I go to a concert, even a classical concert, I move. I can't just sit there still as I listen to music. It's not really in my head. I feel it. And for me, it's sort of, I think, because I live in my head so much, music is the counterpoint. It's the release. But I know for many people, music is a very cerebral experience. It takes them to a very deep intellectual place. What are your thoughts for that difference, which doesn't necessarily match up with other aspects of a person's life?
Well, you know, music is certainly such a complex phenomenon, and it does operate. You know, music that's good for us will operate on a variety of levels. You know, and I think that even when you are just tapping your toe and you're listening to a classical piece or a rock and roll piece, you may not be focusing on those sort of intellectual, those technical parameters, but your brain is. And part of the reason why you're feeling that sort of emotional connection is your brain is processing that sound, those frequencies and those sort of velocities and that create the sort of the beat and the groove. Your brain is sort of making syntactic and semantic sense of it. If there's counterpoint, in other words, two voices going on at the same time, on some level you are paying attention to it. So it's a matter of, like, how do we shift our focus? I think the best music, for me anyway, music of Bach or music of the Beatles, or there's so many great examples, are ones where I can, you know, really focus in on those sort of musical parameters. What is the harmony doing? What are the timbres? How are they interacting with one another?
Highly analytical, yeah.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it's not like it's an either or. I can then the next minute when I feel those, you mentioned those blissful moments, they're called frissons, French for cold, that feeling of chills or shivers down the back of our neck. It is something that many of us experience when we're listening to music. It's actually a little bit more when we turn up the volume. So if you put on headphones, you're more likely to feel that. It's really what we kind of crave in our musical experiences. Intellect, yeah.
Hold that thought. We're going to continue as we take a brief break. You're listening to one of the selections from the Queen's Suite by Duke Ellington, Northern Light. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Perhaps the most familiar classical piece of all time, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. You're tuned to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking with the man who was the architect of Pandora's Music Genome Project, Nolan Gasser, a musicologist, composer, pianist as well. His new book, Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. Our phone lines are open for you at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Nolan, what about group identity that's reinforced for music? Because it does seem that there is sort of a tribal aspect to music, that we are attracted often to music which affiliates us with people that we think of like ourselves. What's behind that?
Well, indeed. I think the role that obviously culture plays, the broader culture that we grow up in, it seeds so many of those musical elements that for us are just sort of our normal expectation, our normal language, those scales that we all know, whether it's in Beethoven or Duke Ellington, it's a system of scales and tuning and the kinds of instruments that are used, those acoustic instruments of brass and reeds and strings. These are normal for us. But if you grow up in a small village in sub-Saharan Africa or in Southeast Asia, there will be different scales, different rhythms, different meters, different timbres. So our broad culture, I think, you know, it's worth us thinking about the fact that we can listen to music of a different culture and we won't necessarily understand it, but we can still, you know, get something out of it. Unlike if they start speaking, we won't really understand what they're saying. But if we go obviously deeper into our culture, it's those subcultural identities, the kind of sort of geographic and economic and demographic and religious and interest groups that we affiliate ourselves with. These not only help to seed and to define and frame our unique musical taste, but that what they really do is they give us access. They give us permission to like and to explore some kinds of music, but not others, and maybe even to reject certain kinds of music. And we need to be careful that we don't let that get too much in our way, because sometimes the groupthink is not always what's in our best interest.
And does that break down when you look at the ways that people are listening to music now? I'm thinking of Pandora, Spotify, different music services that expose people to new music based on the things that they've already listened to or that they've put into their lists. Do you think that this is going to lead to a dramatically different way that we branch out into other music than we would have in the past?
You know, I certainly think that, every generation has, you know, technologies and aspects of the way that music is delivered and presented that help to shape the evolution of the music. A lot of people, you know, think that, given our technology that maybe we're making music too homogenous. I think that's certainly not true, or other sorts of doomsday effects that music has reached the end of its creativity. Obviously, that I believe that's never going to be the case. As long as we are able to make music, you know, we'll continue to find new avenues to express ourselves. But what we need to rejoice in our own day. Just to give you a little sense of context, you know, back in the 1440s, there was a theorist named Johannes Tinctorius who said that nothing that was written more than 40 years ago is worth listening to. And basically that it had no relevance. It was garbage. And if you kind of go through music history from the 1440s through the maybe at least the 1740s and maybe even the 1840s, that was sort of true. But starting in the 19th century, we started to look back on the music of Bach and so forth. And we think about today, there's no music that's kind of off limits. We go back, to Gregorian chant in the 5th century or the early jazz of the 1920s, early rock and roll in the late 40s. So we're so fortunate. At a click of a button, we can get access to so much music. Pandora and Spotify and Apple and all those are, and YouTube, these are tools that we can use. We can start with something that we know and let those algorithms, obviously, I think the Pandora's one is the best, but all those different systems to introduce us to new music. But of course, it's not just we shouldn't be passive and just let others dictate, even Pandora, where our musical trajectory can go. It's up to us to, you know, just sort of identify what's going on in the music and try that technique in a different realm.
We're talking with Nolan Gasser, composer, pianist, musicologist, and author of Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. He's the chief musicologist and was architect of the Music Genome Project, the proprietary musical analysis system behind Pandora's music streaming. Nolan, thank you so much. Good to have you with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste by Nolan Gasser. Stay tuned. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. A guest today, John Waters, his new book, Mr. Know-It-All, The Tarnished Wisdom of a Fifth Elder. I should say of a filth elder. I would not miss a John Waters conversation with Terry Gross. It'll be a lot of fun. Have a great afternoon.